start with the doctrine of estoppel in Pei, because that historically is the by far the older of the two doctrines. But I think it's important to stress, before I discuss the differences in these doctrines, their commonality. What they have in common is a view that, at least in some instances, we are entitled to protection against a loss which we experience as a result of our reliance on something that another person has said. Now, in the doctrine of estoppel in Pei, the goal of the doctrine is to prevent somebody who did say something on which we relied. Let's say that A is the speaker, and A has said something on which B has relied. The goal is to prevent A from testifying that whatever A said was not true. That B, having relied upon what A said, is a sufficient basis for saying to A, sorry, you said it. We will not allow you to deny it. Now, this is not a question of A wanting to deny that he said anything. It's a question of A wanting to deny the truthfulness of the statement that he made at the prior moment. Now, if A had been making a misstatement, knowing that it was a misstatement, and knowing that it was made for the purpose of misleading B, the tort action of deceit would lie against A, and B could collect whatever damages B could show had resulted from B's reliance upon A's misstatement. But in many cases, there's no possibility of proving that A was lying, and that B only wants to say that A expressed something about the reality of the world, and I, with good reason, relied upon what A said, and I've lost as a result. And A should not be allowed to get up on the witness stand and say, oh, well, that thing which I said is not true. It is not so. The fact which I said existed doesn't exist. Now, the limits of the doctrine of estoppel in Pei, I think it's not hard to understand the concern that the courts have for B in B's reliance upon A's statement. But all that the doctrine of estoppel in Pei provided was literally that A could not deny the truthfulness of whatever the fact was. That I shouldn't even say truthfulness, that A cannot deny the existence of the fact which A had asserted was in fact true. It was the fact, A said, and B relied upon that statement. A cannot now get on the witness stand and deny the truthfulness of whatever it was that he said. Whatever the reality was as he represented it, therefore becomes the reality of that lawsuit, or rather of that legal relationship between A and B. Now, that doesn't get B a lawsuit. All that it says is that A can't deny something on the witness stand. Well, where's the lawsuit come from? And so what the casebook has in it, and what I tried to offer as well, were the kinds of instances in which it is meaningful to B to say that, oh, well, Your Honor, because A cannot deny that there was a particular fact, because A said there was that fact, and I relied upon it, I therefore have a claim against A, and that claim could be, for example, in conversion. That is, that A said he had something, and I relied upon it, and therefore A now cannot deny that he has it, and I'm entitled to it, and therefore A is withholding it from me. In this case, the it, whatever it is, doesn't exist, but of course A said it existed. Well, the shortcoming, and this is what we need to know for the purposes of the contracts course, the shortcoming in that particular doctrine, the shortcomings, I should say, in plural, are fairly clear. First of all, we're not talking about A making a statement of fact. We're talking instead about A making a promise. A promise is not a fact. It's a statement of future intention. That's not a fact. It's not describing the world as it is. It's describing something that the speaker says that they will do at some point in the future, maybe at a specific point in the future. So it doesn't meet that circumstance. For example, Mr. Kirksey writing to his sister-in-law, Antelico, he is making a promise to her. He is not stating a fact. He states a fact, the fact, of course, that he has property and that he has room on the property. That's all true. But what counts, what is important to her, is his promise that she will be able to live in some house that he has, in a comfortable house on his property. So that does not, since we're now trying to establish liability based upon promise rather than liability based upon a statement of fact, we cannot for that reason make use of estoppel in pay, traditional estoppel. The same thing's true of the case of the uncle who says to his nephew, I have deposited in the bank account in your name $50,000, and that will enable you to make an offer to Green for his grocery store. Our concern here is not a statement of fact. It's true. He makes a statement of fact. I have deposited $50,000. And now, in the which he's dead, he can't deny it. That is exactly who stands in his shoes. He cannot deny it. The trouble is that the desire is not to deny the statement, proof of the statement, that $50,000 has been deposited in an account in the nephew's name. The problem is that there is no $50,000 in an account in nephew's name. And so no liability arises. Who would be liable? The estate does not deny that the uncle said that he had deposited the money. Of course, if he had deposited the money, it wouldn't be in the estate anymore. That is interesting. It's good that the estate has the money, because it otherwise would be worthless to sue them, but it doesn't work the magic that estoppel in pay works. The estate does not deny, the executor does not deny that the uncle said there was $50,000 deposited in the nephew's name. Fine. But it's no basis of liability. In order to sue the estate, we have to demonstrate that there was a debt which the estate owed to the nephew. In order to do that, we have to show there was a debt that the uncle owed to the nephew. The problem is, on what are we going to found the argument that there is such an obligation? Well, it cannot be estoppel in pay, because estoppel in pay never creates an obligation. It only creates a circumstance in which the defendant cannot deny the truth of something that the defendant said. On the other hand, Section 90 does purport to create such an obligation. If you meet the terms of Section 90, those terms are the material of our discussion at the end of class and will continue to be our discussion on Tuesday. The restatement of first and second are a bit different, but both say that as a predicate, we have to have a promise. So the first thing we look for is a promise. Second, it says that the promisor should reasonably expect to induce reliance. And so we have to demonstrate that in making the promise, a reasonable person in the position of the promisor would have expected that promise to induce reliance. In the case of the nephew buying Mr. Green's grocery store, we would argue in his behalf that when the uncle said, I will make it, actually articulated the importance of the $50,000 to the nephew when he said, this $50,000 will enable you to buy Green's grocery store. Obviously, it will not be difficult to show that the uncle anticipated the possibility that $50,000 being available to the nephew would induce the nephew to go ahead and complete his purchase arrangement with Green for the grocery store. So we have no problem proving the second point. Now, in restatement first, that reliance has to be material, but we don't have to cope with that in Restatement Second, and so let's put it to one side. Once we have the promise that the promisor should reasonably have expected to induce reliance, the next thing we look for is the actual reliance. Here we find that the reliance was that the nephew expended $40,000 to buy the grocery store. So obviously, at a minimum, he has reliance loss of $40,000. Well, even if you use Restatement First requiring that it be substantial or material, you clearly have it here, and Restatement Second does not even require that. What Restatement Second does require, however, is that injustice can be avoided only by enforcing the promise. Well, I think you can imagine the arguments you would make on behalf of the nephew about the injustice that would be visited upon him if, having relied upon his uncle's statement that he had deposited $50,000 in the bank, it turns out that, in fact, there was no $50,000, and he has gone ahead and spent $40,000 of money that he really doesn't have to spend on the grocery store, but he did so. We can show, I think, and argue that it would be dreadfully unjust not to enforce the uncle's promise of $50,000. In any event, that's the way the argument goes. That would bring us to the last sentence of Section 90, Part 1, which says that the remedy shall be limited as justice requires, and that will require us to think about whether or not his recovery is limited to $40,000 or whether his recovery could be $50,000. If this had been a contract supported by consideration, that is, if the uncle had said to the nephew, if you promise to buy Green's grocery store, I promise to give you $50,000. The nephew says, okay, it's a deal. The nephew then goes ahead and buys Green's grocery store for $40,000. There's very little question but that the right measure of damages here, if there were consideration, as there would be in the case as I just stated it, the right measure of damages would be $50,000, and we'll talk about that more when we talk about remedy. If, on the other hand, we are put to the task under Section 90, Section 1 of Restatement Second, we are put to the task of showing why it would be unjust to give the nephew less than $50,000, we may be hard-pressed. There are some arguments. We'll discuss them in class on Tuesday, but the fact is that the nephew has only spent $40,000. He's not spent $50,000. And so the argument here could, on the part of the estate, be, all right, well, maybe on the ground of foreseeable reliance, maybe we should make good the out-of-pocket expenditure by the nephew, that is $40,000, but there's no way that the estate should be liable for the $50,000, the figure mentioned by the uncle in the letter to the nephew. Again, if we think about all of that and then go back to estoppel and pay, we would say that we would have to work out some other theory of liability, and I'm not sure what it would be. So just to try and help out, I think I explored the example of what if, having received the letter, the nephew went to the bank and said to an appropriate officer of the bank, I understand from my uncle that he has established an account in my name with $50,000. Could you confirm that that has been done? And the bank says, yes, we can confirm that that is true. Of course, they were being careless or negligent or what have you, but that's what they say. He then goes out and he buys the grocery store. And now he brings an action against the bank and says to the bank, well, first he makes a demand on the bank saying, okay, I want to withdraw $50,000 from my account in your bank. And they say, you have no account in our bank. So he now brings a lawsuit against them. And they want to prove that he has no account in the bank. But when he tries to do it, the attorney for the nephew, us, let's say, we will object and say, but Your Honor, the bank is stopped from denying that there is an account of $50,000 in the nephew's name because because before this they said there was such an account, and that is a statement of fact. He detrimentally relied upon that statement of fact, and they cannot deny the fact. Well, now the situation the bank is in is that the bank cannot deny that they have an account with $50,000 in it for the nephew, and the nephew is now saying, I want my $50,000. If they don't give it to him, they were guilty of conversion. That is, they, in effect, have stolen the $50,000 from the nephew because they are holding the money and refusing to give it back to the true owner of the money. That would be a wonderful use of estoppel and pay. There is no useful declaration, however, of estoppel and pay against the uncle's estate, because all that you can do with the uncle's estate is preclude them from denying the existence of a $50,000 account in the nephew's name. That doesn't give us a right of action against the estate or against the bank or anyone else that I can think of. I hope this... Though it's largely a repetition of what was said in class, I hope if you listen to this a few times that it will help clarify the problems. If it doesn't, please use our Google group. Ask the question you have in mind. If you can think of an example of something that would confound you, then just give us the example, and I'll try to respond to it, and I hope other some of your classmates will try to respond as well. Thanks. Have a nice weekend. I'll see you Tuesday.